We've traveled to Beverly Hills, California. Actually, this is, Ken, where is this?
Brentwood.
Brentwood. Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ken Carpenter, one of the greatest voices in radio, and one of the nicest guys I hear. That's what. That's the rumor that precedes our visit here.
Good. Glad to hear that.
You have been a top announcer for, well, where did you start?
Well, I started locally here in Los Angeles on local station KFI. That was back in 1930. We came out here with my wife and little baby in 1929, just looking for a job out here. And I'd done no radio work back in my hometown of Peoria, Illinois, at all. But I'd done some advertising work in department stores and things like that, and I was looking for a job out here in advertising work. And I ran into a man in an advertising agency who lights were turned off, they couldn't pay their light bill. It was just the beginning of the Depression in 1929, 1930 this was. And he said, well, you have a nice speaking voice, you know, like they always say. And, well, luckily, being an advertising man, he could get me an audition. So I took an audition at one station, KHJ, and they just hired a man away from KFI. So he took me over to KFI, and I took an audition there. And fortunately, I'd had some old German in high school and Spanish, and their audition at that time was largely musical. And you can't fake German when you're doing German musical terms. And so I just hung around there for about 3 weeks, sitting out in the lobby until they finally put me on steadily. So that was my start in locally on KFI in 1930, which was a very good place to work because they had the NBC hookup here at that time. NBC had no studios here. And any work was done on the network for NBC, KFI did it. So I was able to get some start in the network at that time. Then I went to NBC as staff announcer here when they opened in Hollywood in 1936 and stayed there until 1942, and I freelanced from then on. Mm-hmm.
To get a job as a staff announcer for NBC, we've heard many stories about the announcers' test that they had. Did you have to go through all of that, or had
not when I got my job at NBC. No, they just opened up down here, and well, by that time I had some reputation because I did the four Rose Bowl games on radio in 1934, 1935, and 1936, and those were released over NBC, of course. So I had a certain amount of reputation. Started doing some network shows when they first started. Originating network shows, commercial shows from NBC out here. I won some auditions on those, of course, but not as a staff. No, I didn't have to because my name was fairly well known at that time.
Well, did you said you worked for NBC until about 42?
42, yes.
Now, when did you join the Kraft Music Hall?
Well, that was in 1935 when they moved it out here. It was Paul Whiteman in New York, and they came out here and they were doing some. Bing was doing some just guest appearances on the show and then to originate them out here. Then they decided to bring the whole show out here with Crosby as the chief personnel person, and I won the audition for that. That was in 1935. And then shortly after I left KFI because I was doing a lot of network work and just silly stuff, so I went to the network then. But for the major shows you auditioned, yes, a bunch of local boys would audition for them, of course. But later on, if you get a reputation, then you don't have to. They want you.
Well, you really were, you stayed with, besides doing many other things, you stayed with Bing Crosby almost through his entire radio
career. About. Just about, because I had lots of other shows. The Lux Radio Theater, Lux Video Theater, One Man's Family I had for a long time. And many other shows like that. But I was with Bing even after he left NBC and Kraft. We went on for, General Electric and Chesterfield and Philco and then into a daytime show. So it all spanned quite a long time, yes.
You moved with Bing to ABC when he started doing the tape thing.
That's right. That's when I went. I was freelance, of course, by that time, you see. And could move any place. Of course, you know the reason he left NBC was because they wouldn't let him do the tapes, you see. He was really the one that broke that barrier because his little firm was the man that hired Jack Mullen, the man who got the tape from liberated the tape, as they say, from Germany at the end of the war and brought the first tape machine over here we used. And Benny, of course, properly so, being a singer, he wanted to do his, at least his musical numbers, so they would be perfect. And you don't have to worry about those when you got on the talking part of the show. And NBC would not allow him to do any tape or recordings of any kind on NBC. And he said, goodbye. And that broke the barrier. Uh-huh. And then tape began coming in because everybody demanded it then.
You say you actually used that machine that they brought over?
Yes, you betcha. Same
one. He recorded his stuff
on
it.
Had the German designations on it. Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened to that machine?
Well, it's probably in a museum someplace. An Ampex museum.
Yeah. Gee, well, that really did revolutionize the...
Completely. Yeah. Of course, they'd gone to particularly the Armed Forces Radio Service. Mm-hmm. That I did a lot of work for during the war, the command performance. They perfected using the platters and also making cuts in it. Mm-hmm. They had very skilled men who could, in effect, almost do what we do on tape nowadays, almost, because they get very good at it. So they had really been perfected there of breaking things up so you didn't have to do the whole show live all the way through.
Mm-hmm. I always thought that the reason Bing Crosby wanted to use the tape was, you mentioned that he wanted his songs to perfect, but I always thought it was a convenience thing, being very casual. He just wanted to do it when he wanted to.
We were very casual on the live show. We were very casual and convenient on that. No, it was mainly he wanted the proper voice quality and didn't want to have to rely on it being right during that live time on the air. That was the main reason, and perfectly good reason, of course. All singers have used it since.
Was it a really spontaneous kind of a program, or was it tightly planned?
It was... written spontaneously. Let me say it that way. The chief writer, Carol Carroll, was able to write in the way Bing talked naturally. He was really the first one to pick it up, and the Crosby image, he'd done a lot of motion pictures, but he has a very whimsical way of talking and very interesting way of talking, and this particular writer picked that up and put on the radio show, and then motion picture writers adopted it after that. But it was written in that style, and very little rehearsal, practically no rehearsal, and of course ad-libs were thrown in, but it was pretty much according to the script. But it was the script that was written that made it sound so spontaneous.
You did much more than really being an announcer on the show. You were always a spokesman for the product, but... there was always a certain amount of banter between
fortunate because just as an announcer, that's fine. But once you get to be, as Harry Von Zell and Don Wilson, a lot of other people were part of the show, then it's a much more important thing and, of course, a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's always the kidding, too, because you would kind of play it straight and always try to get back to the commercial, but Bing would always try to deter you.
We had always had a station break routine. That's when we had to have station breaks with the chimes in those days. And we had routines worked up around, I was always a student at a college, the KMH Musical College. And
Kraft Music Hall.
Yeah, that's right. And we had special songs written for us. Hail KMH is our college song. Hail Rain and Snow. And John Scott Trotter wrote that. And he was the orchestra leader, always was. And... I don't know, one time I was called Stacy Unbreak. That was one of the names for the station break.
In the beginning, the Kraft Music Hall, and Bing shows kind of changed their style a little bit. It was an hour in the beginning.
Well, yes, all through the Kraft era, it was an hour. Then when we went to other sponsors on ABC, it became a half-hour show, yes.
There were some Kraft 30-minute shows in the 40s, though?
No. Not with Crosby. There were some in the there were half-hour shows in the summertime sometimes, things like that, but most of the hour shows, yes.
One of the things that strikes me about the Kraft shows was that they were very, you talked about doing things for command performance and Armed Forces Radio during the war, but the Kraft broadcasts were very, very heavy on patriotism and on selling the use, you know, bring the fats to the butcher and buy the stamps.
Well,
I think
that you find that most radio shows were pretty heavy on that during the war. They were a directed effort, of course, not directed, but I mean it was a spontaneous effort, and a cohesive effort to bring that sort of message to the public. And I think radio did a tremendous job during the war. Of course, the selling war bonds and everything. Of course, the greatest job it did, in my estimation, why I was so happy to have been a part of it, particularly during the Second World War, was that it pulled the country together, because every Tuesday night, there was Fur McGee and Molly, there was Bob Hope, all over the country. So it brought it closest to the people. They knew they were all listening, and they were the same thing at the same time, you see. It was a very, very wonderful thing, I think, of holding the country together.
Well, that's another interesting point. Everybody listened to it at the same time,
with the
exception of the repeats for the West Coast,
so to speak. Yeah.
It wasn't like today, they tape it on television. And
you never know when it's on.
No, you don't know when
the thing
is going. Yeah.
At one time, when we were live, we'd do two shows, you know. One for the East Coast, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That would be 8 o'clock release in New York. And then we'd do a show out here at 8 o'clock at night, the same show, done live again. And some of the funniest shows that went on the air was a great MGM star, Frank Morgan, you may remember, a great personality. And he had the MJB show with Meredith Wilson. Meredith! You remember he called Meredith Wilson's orchestra? And after the show to the East, why, Frank would go across the street and enjoy himself the next two or three hours. And the people on the West Coast at that 8 o'clock show heard some of the funniest shows ever. You couldn't understand a word he was saying. They were howlingly funny. And that was one of the reasons for the use of tape, so we didn't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Why was NBC so much against using recorded programs?
Well, it just was against their policy, that's all. You know, you build up a policy over a long period of time and take pride in everything live, but fine, it just has to be broken, as many other things have been broken since then.
Yeah, that's right.
Sure.
You worked for were you working for Armed Forces Radio?
No. I was freelancing at that time. You just went over there and did your job, that's all. No pay, of course, as expected, because they had a wonderful staff of people in the services. Very strange-looking soldiers, I'd say, because they were writers and directors, producers, everything. But they did a beautiful job of entertainment and were very, very meticulous in their work. So, all the performers, of course, worked for nothing. Mm-hmm. But they had a big staff of people that were in the services doing the work.
They did those shows. They recorded all of those shows, but they were done before a live audience.
That's right. Yes.
Who made up the audience? Was it just civilians,
military
people?
Just take them off the street. Yes.
Anybody.
Give out tickets at the USO and various places. You see, and of course tickets were in great demand because they're all the big stars. I recall one show was Bing and Frank Sinatra and Bob Hope. All three of them. You see, you get shows like that with all kinds of stars, and of course, they're all glad to do them. And there were some great shows, of course, that were never heard in this country.
That's right, yeah.
And they were tremendous shows. They were just done overseas.
You were mostly the announcer on that.
Yes, on command performance. Yeah. It worked in skits, too, quite a bit.
They had a couple of series. They had a Mail Call and G.I. Journal and...
Not Jubilee, a name something like that.
But Jubilee was with mainly black performers,
that's right.
I think.
And then there was another one, too, but the Mail Call was a big one, yes. But I just did the command performance show, that's all I did.
Did you ever meet G.I. Jill?
No, I never did. No.
They had a girl disc jockey on it, you know.
Yeah, I know. That's right, yeah.
I always wonder what she looked like. We hate to know, maybe.
Maybe.
Is it true that the command performed most of the Armed Forces stuff came from the same studio where the Lux Radio Theater was broadcast?
For a time, yes. It was always at CBS Sunset and Gower. And, yes, Lux Radio Theater was done there for a time. It was done originally in a theater on Vine Street. Then it was done there and, a couple other places. Mm-hmm. But it was done there for quite some time, yes.
How long were you associated with the Lux Radio Theater?
Well, I'm trying to think. Probably, I started in about 1943, I think, and was with it until its demise when they went to the Lux Video Theater.
Yeah.
Then moved over to the television end of it, into the Lux Video Theater. And that was quite an experience. The early days of television were like the early days of radio to a certain extent. In other words, you tried things, you know, everybody was learning. And the great thing, the thing that I enjoyed, and it was tough, but it was all live. Television was done completely live in those days. We did a kinescope for the repeat out here, But the show itself, the hour video theater, was done completely live, dramatic show. Tough on actors. I don't know how they did it. Because learning their moves, not only their lines and their acting, but their moves, where they had to be, and changing clothes behind sets, you know, with dressers dressing them. And it was a very difficult thing to do. But once you did it, you had a great sense of accomplishment that you could do it.
They must have been out of breath running from one set to
the
next.
They were at times. You know? Oh, no, yes, cut. Yes. Yeah. Yes, you betcha. The stage manager just grabbing and hauling over to the next set. That's quite a sight.
I have listened to the Lux. I grew up listening to the Lux Radio Theater,
yeah.
And was it a really a star-studded show, wasn't it?
It was, yes. You see, the agency, the J. Walter Thompson Company, that produced the show for Chase and Sanborn, had a good in with the motion picture studios, particularly MGM. And at that time, the motion picture studios, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, 20th Century, and Universal, all of them, had contract players. They had stars, or young stars, particularly under contract.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get them to come on the radio show, you see, for not a great deal of money. Because it was really part of their contract to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the other big stars, they just paid. And it was quite a thing to be on the show. But they got many of their players from the studios because the studios said, do it.
Uh-huh.
Then when the contract system ended, which it practically is gone now, there's no studio, has a lot of people under contract, performers. That ended, and there was just no more available talent. Then they'd say, okay, pay me my full price, you see.
Did the studios have an arrangement with, was Lux, I suppose, J. Walter Thompson.
Yes.
They provided them the story, probably for not a heck of a lot of money.
Well, yes, and it'll be rewritten. They'd take an original screen story, and we had a writer that would adapt it for radio,
mm-hmm.
Yes. And so that was really probably the only payment, as far as I know. I don't think they mm-hmm. charged a great deal for the use of the property.
Well, it was always a great plug to
have. Oh, sure.
Yes,
always a good studio plug for their upcoming pictures, too.
Oh, the Lux programs were just loaded with cross-plugs and plugs.
Sure.
So-and-so appeared
to
the courtesy of, and his next picture will be, and on
that's
and
right.
on and on.
That's right. You betcha.
You used to interview the starlets, then, between
mm-hmm.
the acts.
That's right. That's right.
Young Marilyn Monroe and...
and young Catherine Crosby, who afterwards married Bing when she first came up from... Catherine Greenstaff was her maiden name. I think that was it. Came up from Texas, and so I had to interview her. So I said, well, Kathy, come on for the show, back in the green room. We had a green room, very fancy, and so we'll go over the script. And so she started to read, and I said, no, wait a minute, wait. She says, yes, I've done a lot of this work down in Texas. She had been on radio down there, which I didn't know, because some of them could, you know, just barely read. That is difficult to get the timing and everything. But that's the first time I met her, and she was very competent, even when she first came out here, because she'd done some radio work in Texas.
Did you... you worked, of course, for a long time with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I have never heard anyone speak so clearly and so quickly as you at the beginning of those shows. I mean, it was the Chase and Sanborn show with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and
that's right.
Boom, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that was fantastic.
Well, that was your job, of course. Uh-huh. I remember one time, one introduction on a show, it was a show called with Eddie Duchin, the inimitable piano fingers of Eddie Duchin. Now, you want to say that real fast. And the announcer, I did it for some time, well, you're just standing there, and blood had poured on your face before you had to say that. You had in an up voice, too. Piano, beautiful. And that's what one announcer said one day. That was a brute.
Did you ever have any really bad moments like that?
No, not really. No, I've always, people say, what funny things, strange things happened to you. I never had too many of them, no. I had some experiences, but nothing outstanding like that that really hurt at all. I've done things that were very peculiar at the time. That is, I did a crew race once, never having seen a crew race in my life, and they're the dullest things to broadcast in the world anyway, because you can't see who's ahead till you get right opposite you. And I'd heard that you could count the stroke, you know. So I used a stopwatch, and I didn't know how to count a stroke, so I had them going about 40 miles an hour, and various things like that. But I did some sports. I say football out here on the coast for the Associated Oil Company at that time broadcast the Coast football games and four Rose Bowl games. And the Rose Bowl games, they gave me a real in back east. That was where I really got a good start because particularly at the Rose Bowl game in 1934, that was the first one I did. It was a Columbia-Stanford game. And, of course, Stanford was greatly favored, and that was the day of the year it rained. We had 11 inches of rain in Pasadena the night before, day and night before. And the field was covered with water. In the morning, we went down to see it. You could just see the tops of the benches. And they got fire engines to pump it out. So during the game, which Columbia finally won, to everybody's surprise, you couldn't see it. The players were covered with mud. You couldn't see the lines or anything. Oh, it was an awful mess. But at the end of the game, right toward the end of the game, Columbia was down at Stanford, about 13, 14-yard line. And they used the old hidden ball trick. The quarterback just tucked the ball behind his hip and started out the left and then passed off to Barabbas was his name. I'll never forget his name, a halfback. And he just walked through the left side of the line. Nobody saw it because it was getting dark by that time and it was so wet and muddy. Well, I didn't see it either. But there was a man from Columbia acting as a spotter standing right behind me. The minute the play started, he'd been waiting for it. Reached over my shoulder and put his pencil right on Barabbas' name, and I said, "It's Barabbas." And I said, "It's a touchdown." You know? But, so I got a great deal of credit back in New York for that. People who were listening to the game back there, being Columbia from New York, and the clubs back there, the newspapers next morning said, "Nobody saw the touchdown." These guys said, "Well, that announcer did, you know." Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't see it at all. As I told the group once, I'm not giving the money back.
Well, you really earned your money. Did you work with Truth or Consequences for a little
while?
Yes,
I did, yeah.
Did you have to warm up the audience?
Oh, sure. We had a great audience warm-up, though. Of course, everybody participated in it, and Ralph and everybody else. And they had a lot of gags, lots of stunts. And one of the greatest warm-up stunts, I think, has ever been used. We had a guy spotted down the front row. And Ralph, just before he went on the interview, announced, "Now, ladies and gentlemen, the we're about to start performance, and the doors will be closed, the studio, so nobody's allowed to enter or leave while we're in performance in progress." And this plant stooge gets up and says, "Oh, no, I'm getting out of here," and starts running down the aisle, and the producer, Ed Bailey, has a big 22 target pistol blank, and blam, shoots right back, and the guy staggers on down, you know, and out the... But that will wake an audience up anything, and that's the greatest waker-upper I ever saw. It's a wonderful warm-up. Yeah.
When that show would come on the radio, the first thing you'd hear would be a loud...
We always had some stunt going on, some guy trying to get into a corset or something. Uh-huh. That was it.
The timing was just such that bang,
right.
It would come in at the right time.
That way. Mm-hmm.
You never got involved in any of the stunts, did you?
No, not picking the stunts, no.
You have to stay away from
but
the
pies. But it was lots of fun.
And
they're still going strong on television,
yeah.
Guys. Those guys are all very close friends of mine.
Besides the Lux Video Theater, what were you involved with on television?
Well, I did quite a few commercials, of course. Mm-hmm. I had 1 year, there was a Ford program, an hour program, a television show, and I did the announcing and commercials for that. It was one year for Kraft with the Milton Berle, half-hour show, and then some commercials. That's about the extent of it. Some openings and closings off camera, of course, but... Not too much work as a personality on camera, no.
Did you ever do much work in films?
Yes, quite a bit, but always as myself, practically. You know, always as an announcer or something like that. Not as a performer, not at all.
I mean, in a story, you were the announcer.
That's right, that's right. That's the way I was used, yes. Did, of course, a lot of voiceover stuff, like speaking of animals... odd occupations and things like that. They were serial. They used to have shorts that went on the theater. They don't have them much anymore. But there was a time when they had lots of shorts, and they were very, very interesting, good work.
Narrated some documentaries and the...
Oh, yes, certainly.
You weren't involved in the... Well, you must have done the voice in some newsreels. Didn't you do something?
No, never did any newsreel work. No.
I think Ed Herlihy, I think.
That's right. Most of them were done back in New York. Most of the newsreel work was done there. They were all their head offices were there, and they were all their work was done there.
What was the best thing you've... been associated with? What did you enjoy the most?
Oh, I don't know. I enjoyed the whole thing. That is, radio was a wonderful time to work in those days, a great time, because that was it. People had that for entertainment, and the great thing about it was, I think, about radio above television, is it was It was consistent, but the show went on and stayed in that same spot year after year after year. And I think it sold merchandise regardless of ratings just because it was there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's unfortunate that they switched the shows around so much. You get used to a television show in a certain particular spot at night. You look forward to it. All of a sudden, it's on a different night.
Yeah.
And this didn't happen in radio. It stayed the same place. And that sense of continuity, and were very wonderful people to work with all the way through, from the network personnel to agency people to actors and everybody. We have a group out here of we call Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters,
mm-hmm.
and we have about 800 members. That's people who had 20 years in radio, 15 years in television, in any capacity. That includes musicians, script girls, everybody who work in the medium. And we have a big time. You know, people love to get together and see each other,
mm-hmm.
you know.
A little more friendly than the...
Much more.
Today,
it was very
huh?
close, because uh-huh. you worked in studios that were close to each other. NBC and CBS were mm-hmm. just down the street. And in Chicago, you know, the Merchandise Mart
yeah.
and the Tribune Tower were right across the street yeah. from each other. And the guys used to run back and
right.
forth with the soaps then.
Did you ever work in Chicago?
No, I never did. No, I always worked out here.
Uh-huh. You've been out here since 29, and you've just...
Mm-hmm.
The sunshine and the no mm-hmm. snow.
You betcha. I stayed out here particularly because... just when I went to, in the mid-30s, some of the shows started coming out because the big like Jack Benny came out to do a motion picture and then went back to New York, but then finally came out here and stayed because he liked it better out here. And all the people like that started having to come out to do a picture, then they decide they want to stay out here. That's when the radio production of the big shows, comedy shows particularly, started coming out here the coast. And I could see that coming. That's one of the reasons I always stayed out here, because I knew it was coming out here.
Did you enjoy working before a studio audience?
Yes, I don't mind working for an audience. I hated the warm-up part. Most warm-ups, when you've got to go out and, well, to warm up an audience for Milton Berle, that is a miserable experience. Berle had nothing to do with that. I mean, but, you know, they're waiting for him.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Yeah.
But some guys like it, and some guys do it. I never liked to do it. It was tough to do. But as far as the audience itself working with it, well, that's great. Sure, working in front of an audience and getting laughs, that's...
Yeah, it's much better getting immediate reaction to it, response.
Right, you never get over that. That's why actors and comedians never quit.
Yeah.
They love it.
How long would a warm-up take? Would it be 5 minutes?
Oh,
yes,
yeah, about five. They would want you to take 5 minutes. I'd take less than that, because I hate to stand out there and tell people, laugh, you know. When we hold up a sign or when I give you the thing, you laugh. I never could figure myself. If I'd been in the audience, I'd refuse to. I know. That's my mentality. But you had to do it.
Uh-huh.
As I say, some guys had a whole string of jokes. And they just tell them, you know. And I was never a jokester like that.
What have you been doing lately?
Well, I've been retired for quite some time
uh-huh.
now. But as I keep active in AFTRA, as you possibly know,
uh-huh.
and the Union of Performers. And... in this Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters group of ours, we have 5 luncheons a year. That's our extent of our activities. We're also collecting memorabilia. We have a beautiful collection of tapes and recordings mm-hmm. and everything. Vice president of that, so I keep my hand in the industry and a few little things like that, but most of the time I'm gardening, golfing, and generally enjoying my senility.
It looks like it agrees with you. Let me say, suppose someone said, Ken Carpenter... we're going to try something revolutionarily new, that's the right word, on radio today.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a live variety show with a popular singer,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to have some comedy spots,
mm-hmm.
and we'd like you to be the announcer.
Sure.
Would you do it?
Oh, yes. Love it, of course. Oh, no question about that. Yes, you're always glad to get back in the business, because CBS has started this show at night, you know, the mystery
mm-hmm.
shows, and
mm-hmm.
I'm still doing fairly well. And there's quite a bit of demand from the public for radio shows on radio, which they haven't been for a long time. It's very difficult because of the expense. Stations just won't pay for it. The networks can't clear the time.
Yes, but, you know, we were talking before about a radio show would go on. It would be on Tuesday night at 6
yeah.
o'clock or whatever
yeah.
it would be, and it would
yeah.
stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And they really could give it a long, a good solid chance to
That's
establish
right.
itself
That's
because
right.
There were no expenses in sets.
No,
you know,
that's
didn't
it.
Have to do
that's
anything.
Right. The costs were so much less.
You got the writers, and that was it.
Certainly,
television today they take four shows, and if they, you know, if it isn't number two in the ratings
away,
they want to kill it
off
the bat.
You betcha.
Could we ever get some radio back again? Do you think might be able to?
I don't know. I just don't know. It's been an awful lot of efforts made by some very good people. And this last one, which CBS went into, the night show, is doing pretty well. And, of course, the actors love it to go back into a radio studio and only rehearse for just about, you know, an hour and a half. All it takes to do the rehearsal and everything. It's simple. But whether there'll be any widespread coming back of radio shows like the soap operas and variety shows or anything else, I don't think so. I don't think
so. Well, we'd like to hope so, though.
Yes, we certainly would, but I'm afraid it's because there's been a great deal of effort put behind it. But I don't know. It's just doesn't seem to work out.
Well, you put a lot of effort into the many things that you've done during your career, and it has shown, and I'd like to thank you for that and for this, too.
Chuck, thank you very much for coming out.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My greetings to everybody in the Middle West.
Thank you, Ken.